See, everyone who called me from, you can't come with me down to Calgary because I brought my wife, and normally her luggage is a lot, and then now we bring our son, and so it's a whole new thing. I just became a father in November of last year, and so now we have compounded our luggage situation to an extravagant level, to an ostentatious level. It's funny, when Jen first got pregnant with Gunner, that's his name, and people are funny about that too, right? They were all like wanting to know what his name was before he was born, and I wouldn't tell anybody because I was convinced that they were going to do what a lot of people had already done, which is steal our names. A lot of people stole our names. We would come up with a really cool name, and somebody would have a baby before us, and they would take that name. So he said, I'm not telling anybody any of the names anymore. People say, well, I'm not even having kids. You might be a spy. But we named him Gunner, and it's funny, I'll run into people who be like, that's a strange name for a Mennonite pastor's son. Not E-R-A-R, it's a Scandinavian thing. We say Gunnar, but we're Canadians, and we know that lots of people, as teachers, are never going to say Gunnar. They're going to say Gunner. So we thought we'd just get that over and done with and call him that. But it's A-R, not E-R. When Jen was first pregnant, though, people just started coming up with sort of a sadistic glee on a regular basis. And they continued to do this throughout the year, and they would say something to us. They'd come up and they would say, having this baby is going to change your life. Really? Oh, no. Let's take it back, honey. I thought, man, you got to be kidding that people would come up and... And I know it's just a small talk thing, right? It's the kind of thing you want to relate to somebody who's having a baby and you don't know what else to say. Like, my, you're huge, you know? You don't want to say anything like that. So you say, this baby's going to change your life. And they would say it, like I said, with sort of a sadistic glee. Like they were waiting for the moment that my life, like, my wife's a planner, and so she keeps us pretty organized. I'm a complete nutball. I'm a chaotic person, and so, you know, I don't mind a little chaos and everything, but she had us working everything really good, and we had our lives together, and I think people were just sort of like, all right, here comes the craziness, you know? And they were waiting to see it happen. I think they were a little disappointed when Gunner finally showed up, because he's perfect. And I know, all parents say it, but I've got facts to back it up. When Gunner was nearly here, people would say, get lots of sleep, you're not going to have any shortly. And I thought, I'm a student. When have I ever slept? Well, this is going to be different. I'll have a study buddy. It'll be great. And Gunner came along, and the church that I work for, Holy Roof Mennonite in Edmonton, was wonderful enough to give me a month of paternity leave at Christmas. Can you imagine? Letting the pastor go in December blew me away. So I had a month to sort of spend with him. And we'd show up, and I looked a little bit, you know, too bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and someone's like, well, you look like you're getting lots of sleep. And I'm like, I am. They're like, really? I'm like, yes. Other parents of children the same age would come up to us looking like zombies from a George A. Romero film, and they would say, yeah, you know, he only sleeps for 20 minutes and then he's up again, or, you know, we get 2 hours and then we're back at it. How many hours does your baby sleep? 5. 5 hours. That's a full night's sleep for a newborn baby. We got 5 hours! And they said, it's probably a phase. Woe betide you! They want it to go bad at some point. This baby's gonna change your life. And when the baby didn't change our lives as much, they said, it's just a phase. And they were right. Gunner stopped sleeping 5 hours. Now he sleeps 7 to 9! So he's perfect. And he's really happy. I was walking around with him one time, somebody came on and said, oh, look, he's having his happy time. I said, no, he's not. This is all the time. He has a cranky time once in a blue moon. And it's kind of blown us away. So now what do people say when we tell them we've got a perfect baby when we back it up with facts?
You just wait.
Either for the next kid or just somewhere along the line when Gunner decides to become rebellious, which in my world would just mean that he's like, gonna listen to classical music? But, you know, they do change your life. I can't deny that. They do change your life. It's been a good change. My dad sent me this in an email, and I thought I would share it with you to sort of kick into the rest of our session together. Parents' job description. Some of you may have read this. Long term, read the rest of your life. Team players needed for challenging permanent work in an often chaotic environment. Candidates must possess excellent communication and organizational skills and be willing to work variable hours, which will include evenings and weekends and frequent 24-hour shifts on call. Some overnight travel required, including trips to primitive camping sites on rainy weekends and endless sports tournaments in faraway cities. Travel expenses not reimbursed. Extensive courier duties also required. Responsibilities must be willing to be hated, at least temporarily, until someone needs $5. Must be willing to bite tongue repeatedly. Also must possess the physical stamina of a pack mule and be able to go from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 3 seconds flat in case this time screams from the backyard aren't someone crying wolf. Must be willing to face stimulating technical challenges such as small gadget repair, mysteriously sluggish toilets, and stuck zippers. Must screen phone calls, maintain calendars, and coordinate production of multiple homework projects. Must have ability to plan and organize social gatherings for clients of all ages and mental outlook. Must be willing to be indispensable 1 minute, a complete embarrassment the next. Must handle assembly and product safety testing of 500,000 cheap plastic toys and battery-operated devices. Must always hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst. Must assume final, complete accountability for the quality of the end product. Responsibilities also include floor maintenance and janitorial work throughout the facility. Possibility for advancement or promotion? None. Your job is to remain in the same position for years without complaining, constantly retraining and updating your skills so that those in your charge can ultimately what? Surpass you. Previous experience, none required, and there's no books of really work on the subject. On-the-job training offered on a continually exhausting basis. Wages and compensation, get this, you pay them. Offering frequent raises and bonuses. A balloon payment is due when they turn 18 because of the assumption that college will give them some sort of financial independence. When you die, you give them whatever's left. The oddest thing about this reverse salary scheme is that you actually enjoy it and wish you could only do more. Well, and benefits, while no health or dental insurance, pension, tuition reimbursement, paid holidays or stock options are offered, this job supplies limitless opportunities for personal growth and free hugs for life if you play your cards right. We understand that having a physical child is going to change our life. That changes will occur when you have a baby in the house, when you have children in the house. Life is different, life gets changed. We have no problem getting that. But it seems that, and I lump myself in this, so don't ever get the impression during this session that I'm somehow saying, it's you. Whether it's any one particular person, but as a church, we struggle with the idea that having spiritual children changes our lives. We struggle with the idea. Earlier, Foothills was called a child of the conference. That's the kind of spiritual children I'm talking about. But we're speaking specifically tonight about youth. What is the sort of future of youth in our conference? It's a repeated question. Why don't the youth want to come to our church? Why don't the youth stay in our church? And I was speaking with Doug earlier, and he said very eloquently, the real question is, were they ever here? You know? We ask the question, why don't they stay when they turn 18? And the question on the youth pastor's mind is, were they ever here? When I first got to one church that I worked for, I had people coming up to me within the first 2 weeks going, when are we going to see some baptism services? And I'm thinking of the Bible study I had with these kids the other night where I asked them some basic questions about Christianity and they couldn't tell me anything about their faith. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure they're Christians. I'm not putting them in any water or splashing anything on top of them until I know for sure. So let's just wait and see what happens. Were they ever here? See, we've got this model of youth and children's ministry where we usher them out, you know? Halftime comes to the service. I don't know if they do that here at Foothills, but we do it in our, we used to do in our church. Now we keep them in, and we usher them out. Okay, it's halftime. The sermon part is coming. And what are we telling them? It's going to get so boring. No, I don't know. I don't know what it means.
chance. But we're telling them that you go out there and you do your thing, and we'll stay in here and do ours. And we kind of do the same thing with youth ministry. We give youth their own pastor. And we call them pastor, but what we really mean is fun director. You know? And you're like, oh, no. We want our youth pastors to give Bible studies. No, they don't. Because I did a whole, semester of Bible study this one time, and they were creative Bible studies. They were interactive Bible studies. They were Bible studies that youth should have really done. And you know what happened at the end of that? The parents came to me and they said, Maury Vance, our kids aren't having fun anymore. And I knew that my job was fun director. See, we say we want young people in the church. We want young people to be part of our church. But I'm not fully convinced that we are ever really ready for what that means. We say we want youth to become involved. And what that means is we'd like them to usher. When I have people coming in and say, we'd like to see the youth more involved, they want them to usher. They want them to work in the sound booth. They want them to maybe read scripture. But if one of them decides, and I know this from experience, that they're going to be a musician in the church, they don't really want them to lead worship without some parameters, right? You know, I can remember having a conversation with some parents about this, you know. Their kids were going to start doing worship in the church, and they said, well, they're going to have to learn to do some hymns. And I said, just as soon as some of those older folks learn the choruses and lead them, I'm willing to go to the young people and tell them that they can do that. But I don't expect that from my seniors. I don't want them to do choruses. It's painful for them. It's painful for me. The youth doing hymns is kind of painful in a way. And I'm rabbit trailing a little bit here, but I'm just sort of, you know, building. I was explaining to somebody earlier that I've been in youth ministry for 15 years, and nobody's ever asked me to talk about this. So if at times I sort of become Mount St. Helens exploding with information, you'll know why. Because youth pastors never get asked for their opinion. Not so that people actually want to hear it. No, I'm kidding. We do. But we always have to qualify. We always have to defend what we're doing. You know, why are you guys doing that crazy event where you run up and down the pews? You know, that kind of thing. We have to qualify. We say we want youth to come to church. We're not really committed to what that means. I was working in a church this one time where we had a young boy come out to the service. He would have been about grade 6. By himself. He just showed up one morning. And he plunks himself down in the pew. And the time comes around for us to sing. And I noticed that you know, here at Foothills, there's two different books. You know, and which book do you pick up if you've never been in church? And in this particular church, there was a multiplicity of books, including a Bible. And when it came to the singing time, he went for the Bible. He wasn't sure what to do. He had no idea what he was doing in church. And he was just trying his best to sort of figure it all out. And people just kind of looked at him and wondered, what an oddity, what a curiosity, what a strange thing this is. This child over here by themselves without a parent here in church. He came up to my Sunday school class and we were reviewing a popular film and its relationship to scripture and things that we might be able to learn about the Christian life. And he enjoyed himself so profusely that he came back the next week and he brought his brother and he brought his sister. Now they were younger than he was and they really shouldn't have been in my class, but I knew that if I sent them off, we might lose them. So I thought I would just keep them in my class. What I found out later was that during our service where we had begun to serve coffee and pop, they had drank lots of pop. We sent those kids home wired every week to whatever parents weren't coming with them. This went on for a while. And like I say, they didn't know how to act in church. They didn't know how to behave in church. They weren't quite sure what the secret handshakes were and all that sort of thing. Business meeting comes up. We get through all the items on the agenda and we come to other. And somebody raises the issue of the young children who've been coming and drinking so much pop! And I'm thinking, on the list of things we have to care about as a church, this is on page 200, after are we eating too much garlic as a church? But it gets its airtime. And suddenly we're talking about the integrity of the carpet. And what happens if one of those kids spills some pop on the carpet? I was so incensed. I wanted to get up the next week when I preached with a can of green pop and just spray it all over the place and go, there, we got it out of the way. Now we can get on with caring about people and less about the carpet. But I didn't. I wanted to keep my job. What happened was that the parents of those kids, those truant parents, got a phone call. Please don't send your kids until you're willing to come with them.
I was the youth pastor. Nobody asked me what we should do in that situation.
You know, really hard to sort of keep your cool. And so if I'm passionate about it, it's because I've seen some of the sides of this situation where we say, we really want kids. I've had an email come to me. At one church I was working in where it started out with, I remember the days when we would come to church and it was quiet, it was peaceful, we'd meditate before the service, and it was totally, this somber, reflective time. And now we've got all these kids in the church and they're making all this noise. Noise, 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 noise. It was like the Grinch stole Christmas. And then at the very end of the email, I don't understand why we're losing our young families. I thought, did you read the first part of your letter? I don't know why we're losing them either. I wonder. I can't imagine why. Genesis 9 verse 12 says, God's covenant with Abraham was for all generations to come. God was to be Abraham's God and the God of the descendants after you. That's from chapter 17, verse 7. Passover feast was ordered to be celebrated as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. That phrase, the exact phrase, generations to come, in the NIV is found 39 times. But if you extrapolate it to its meaning, where you might have the same Psalm 22, we see future generations, it shows up more than 100 times. It seems to be important to pass the torch to the next generation. That's what's talked about in the pastoral epistles to Timothy. Passing of the torch. Paul had started a ministry, now he's passing it on to someone else. In Psalm 22, it says, not only that future generations will be told about the Lord, that they will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn. So it's not only just the generations that are to come, but they're going to do the same thing, and they're going to do it to a generation that isn't even born yet. Psalm 45, verse 17 says, I will perpetuate your memory. I love that word, perpetuate. It's powerful. I will perpetuate your memory through all generations. That's key. Therefore, the nations will praise you forever and ever. In Psalm 78, the writer says, I will open my mouth in parables. And just in case you guys were worried, because I think you gotta worry when somebody like me comes along and starts talking about, you know, youth in the church. And now it's going to be drums every Sunday. Well, that's not what I'm advocating for. I'm not advocating for us to become churches that just center down towards youth or towards children or towards any one generation. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things, things from of old. I love that. Things from of old. Our traditions, the place we've come from. The things that make us distinctly Mennonite, the things that make us distinctly Anabaptist, the things that make us distinctly Christian. What our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from our children. We will not hide them from our children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, etc., etc. Now let's look at that. We will not hide them from our children. In Mark 10, 14, Jesus tells his disciples, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them. But what do we do most of the time with the way we communicate the gospel? We hinder them. Say, wow, we've got a Sunday school program. Cool. Not every church struggles with this. There are exceptions.
I haven't worked as many of those. Because we do hinder them. We use a lot of difficult words, even for adults. We communicate in modes that children get all week at school. Somebody talking at them. Then we do it one more time, so that we want them to tune in. Where do we focus most of our energies as churches? I believe we focus most of it in adult ministry. Which is interesting, because we all know how to read. We, as we grow older, go back to school. We choose to go there. Something that a child would never do. They can't wait to get out of school. We hinder them. I believe we do. If we didn't hinder them, I wouldn't need to be talking about this. I wouldn't need to hear somebody say to me, why is it that children don't want to be in church? Why is it that the young people leave when they're 18? Why is it that young people don't want to come? How can we get the next generation to know? How can we pass the torch? Why are we having a leadership crisis in just about every church in North America? Torch isn't getting passed, and we're worried about it. I'm worried about it. Somebody has said that the church is always one generation away from extinction. How do we turn it around? See, because when we say we do not hide it from our children, we have to think about when we talk to a child, we change the way we speak. When I talk to a little child, I change the way I talk. I have to think. I can't, why is the sky blue? Well, it's the sun's rays refracting off the ozone layer, which causes a change in the prismatic makeup of, your ability to perceive through your optic nerve. No, because God thought it was pretty. It's quite often the response that I might have, It's different for kids. We talk different to kids. And yet when we do what we do in church, we sort of just do what we've always done. And I don't want to step on toes with that statement. Because I'll tell you, I know how to rock the boat. I excel at it. I don't even try, and I rock the boat. I'm a boat rocker. Third generation boat rocker. My grandfather tried to put a pool table in the basement of a Baptist church in Bowness here in Calgary. My father played Beatles tunes for offertories as instrumentals. So it's not my fault I'm this way. We must make sacrifices to bring the gospel to a new generation. I believe the key is in Romans 14. I'm not going to go into it heavily. For those of you who know it well, you know that this is a passage about weaker brothers and stronger brothers. Or we could say weaker sisters and stronger sisters. Weaker people and stronger people. First time I ever heard that passage was when I was going to Bible school, and we had a lifestyle agreement, where guys didn't wear earrings, and I had one. And so I wore mine on the weekend when I was at home. Oh, thank you. I forgot to take it out this one morning. It just happens to be the morning I walk into the school building as one of the most generous givers is walking out, and he sees me, and you just get used to it. You see the eyes. This was in 1990, when it was still questionable if a guy had it in what particular ear it made him gay. And so as I'm walking in with this earring and my hair and everything else, he looks, and unbeknownst to me, while I'm in my first class, goes to the president of the school and makes his complaint. The president of the school calls me into his office and reads Romans chapter 14 to me. And I said, is it elderly gentleman who had the problem with me? Yeah. New convert, hey? Pardon me? Well, he's got to be a new convert. At the very least, he has to be 5 years in the faith. Why is that?
Well, I'm just a little confused about this whole weaker brother thing. It says here that the weaker brother is supposed to put up with the failing, or the stronger brother is supposed to put up with the failings of the weaker brother.
Yes.
So you're saying I'm the stronger brother here? No, that's not what I'm saying. But the passage says that the stronger brother is supposed to put up with the failings, and I was being a jerk. I know that. I was young.
arrogant. Now I'm old and arrogant. But I've heard that, you know, that not that passage directly, but that idea sort of coming out that the young people and the children have to put up with whatever we throw at them because church isn't supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be a place where, and I've heard these sorts of things, we learn values. We learn how to behave properly in church. Now let's go back 50 years, shall we, to the beginning of this particular congregation. Might not have been considered proper to have an English-speaking congregation. Mennonites or anything like Baptists, it certainly wasn't, because that was a huge thing, you know. As soon as a German church became an English-speaking church, heresy, you're all, you know, you're in trouble now. If we go 100 years back, we'd have even more changes, wouldn't we? And how should we behave in church? Ladies, where's your hat? The fact that this church exists and has a vibrant ministry today is that somebody had the guts to go ahead and try something new for people who had yet been unreached, a generation that hadn't heard, right? And somebody was good enough to be respectful and tolerant of the people who started it and who started the churches that most of us go to, because there's a lot of English-speaking Mennonite churches now. This does not come from some sort of decision where we say, okay, well, now we'll go ahead and put the drums on the pulpit. Not the point. The drum thing, the worship style thing, the clothing thing, the showing movies during the service thing, all that stuff, it's red herrings. If we get bogged down with the particulars, we're gonna lose it, because by the time we figured out what this particular generation is into and we've perfected our way of showing it to them in worship, it'll be a new generation who needs to hear. What works today will not work tomorrow. You want the key to this? Let the kids in. Let the youth lead. And help them to do it. Because if you're there with them, you can show them when they blow it. You don't have to dictate it all to them, because sooner or later, if they love you enough, and they ought to, they will want to serve you. The trouble is that we don't often wait long enough for them to do it. I got the opportunity when I was in my mid-20s, at a time when I was dying, to be able to lead worship musically in the churches I was serving. And we got a new worship pastor in, and he said, I want your band to lead worship. My band played bars. This is not even chorus music. Take it as far to the most horrifying thing you can think of in your morning service, and you have approximated what we sounded like. But we knew we were going to be in the morning service, so we said, let's build it back. We won't do what we normally do. We're going to do what we think will serve our congregation. We agonizingly went through the hymn book until we found a hymn that we felt we could tackle. It was Be Thou My Vision. Unfortunately, it was in the middle of our third worship set. The first three songs we did, one of which was a rocked-up version of the song that goes, Hallelujah, thine the glory, hallelujah, amen. So we'd thrown out the melody and the tempo and everything but the words. It's always interesting to me that God gave us the Psalms, but no notation for their music. Just a thought. We got through the first three songs, and I saw a sight that I remember from the church I grew up in. I also saw another sight that I'd seen. It was people's posteriors as they headed for the door. And I thought, oh no, but it's okay, because when we get to Be Thou My Vision, we're going to let them know how much we love them, how much we care. Yes. We never made it there. We went to sit down, and the drummer that was playing with us that day had left the church and had said, I'm never coming back. And I said, come on, man. Believe me, one more time, it's going to be okay. Drummers are some of the most berated people in churches across the world. I don't know. Maybe not in Africa. And he was sitting there, and he could see as the usher came over to talk to us. I saw his countenance drop because he knew what was up.
You guys will not be finishing the worship service. He should inform us. Pastor's passing this along to us. The so-and-so who played the piano at the drop of a hat, this wonderful pianist who read music like I read English, was going to come in and finish the service. We had been deemed unacceptable. And he never did go back to church. He never did set foot back into a congregation. He never darkened their door. People of God, now is the time to be willing to minister to the generations who are yet to come. But take heart in this, because I truly believe that if we invest in the youth, in the next generation, that they will return the favor. It will not happen immediately. You will have to endure possibly spilled grape pop. But at some point, God is faithful. I believe he is. He will build in their hearts a care and a love for the people that have served them. They will begin to appreciate the tradition that they stand upon, if that tradition will appreciate them. And in this way, when we say that we must have I'll use the word ethos because it's like a groundwork, something that we're going to stand upon. If we're going to have an ethos as a church for the next generation, we must never make it for any one particular one, because then they'll just grow up to be self-absorbed. Instead, what we will do is we will take the next generation down and we will say, I serve you and what you're doing. And we can serve the generation who's next in the other direction too. So for me, as they labeled me Generation X, I get to minister to millennials, they're the next ones up, and I minister to boomers, they're the ones that are my parents' age. The boomers get to minister to Generation X. It doesn't need to be this clean cut, I'm exaggerating to some degree. But do you get what I'm saying? We minister to the generation down, and we minister to the next generation up. Let's not worry about our own. And if we all did that, we'd all get taken care of. Because what happens usually when we talk about this, somebody says, well, what's going to happen to the seniors? Or what's going to happen to the adults? And my challenge to you is to not care. I don't care what happens to me in that sense. I can't remember the last time. I'm exaggerating here. I'm not trying to make myself into a hero. I don't like doing that sort of thing. But we can't make it about us. As Jesus, washing his disciples' feet, says, love each other in a servant manner. We have to do it in our services. We have to do it in our ministries. We have to be able to say, I'm going to totally give it up. I'm going to give up my hymns, and I'm going to give up my quiet service. I'm going to give up my orderly worship. I'm going to let it fly. And I believe that God's going to give it back to you. As I've gone on in life, my favorite form of worship is contemplative. I don't like rock and roll worship services. Not personally. I can deliver one, but I don't like it. I like a service that is quiet, that is subdued, that I don't always have to sing along with everything, that the prayers are in silence. I'm 35. Still fairly young. And I look like the guy who ought to like the rock and roll. I'm over talking. The people of God now, building an ethos that serves the generation yet to come, so that they can hear and they can know, and the torch will be passed. Thanks so much for letting me speak, trusting Crazy Youth Pastor to say a few words at a conference meeting. It's great. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. I'm really glad I know you now. I just feel great about the way this conference has started. I have to say, I was a bit nervous. But I feel great. I feel